Welcome to Turning Towards Life. This is Lizzie and Justin, and we are Third Space and Turning Towards Life today. We come here every Sunday morning, Justin, from 9 a.m. UK time, and it's a complete delight to be in this every week interruption of normal life. And of course, it's a Sunday morning, so both of us have got kerfuffleages of family around us and children and goodness knows what else, and it feels so well, it's an example of all the things that have to be rearranged in order for us to fulfill this commitment. And all of the people in my house, in my family, in my extended family, are all completely geared around Turning Towards Life having on a Sunday morning, so everybody kind of gets into gear. And this morning the clocks have changed, so it's all a bit of a kerfuffle. And I'm just really appreciating the boundary of this practice that has everybody arrange themselves. And it shows me the power of when we just keep doing something, how people get used to it, even though at the beginning it might be weird or whatever. My system is now completely fully committed, as well as me. And I just really appreciate that that's what happens with this kind of practice, is that the world rearranges itself miraculously around what it is that we are committed to. So I'm feeling grateful for that, and for everybody's assistance, and for this not just being me who's here, but a whole system, family system, that's here in support of me doing this. Good morning to you, Justin, and thank you for choosing this ridiculously amazing source again for us today.
Oh, good morning, Lizzie. I'm very pleased to be here, and hello, everybody. And excited to talk about this source. Yes, but before that, I'm really taken by what you said about how life can rearrange itself around our practices. So, my family knows all about this, of course. And everyone tiptoes around the house on a Sunday morning, and we shut all the doors, and everybody knows not to yell upstairs and all of those kind of things. But actually, I was also thinking about my organizational life, because you'll know this, Lizzie, but I've become this year chair of the board of trustees of an organization that I care about very deeply, where people would very often meet probably at 9 on a Sunday morning. If people wanted to gather for something important to happen, it would be 9 on a Sunday morning. And I have said, taught everybody that 9 on a Sunday morning is this, and this doesn't move. This hasn't moved. This is what, to me, practice involves, is creating fierce enough, loving enough structure to hold us. And the amazing thing about it is it holds us. And as you and I have been finding out, somehow the number of people who encounter this body of work is doubling. It's doubled since last year, which is very exciting to know that there are people who are in our orbit, in the orbit of this and all this. But also that the world, it is possible sometimes that the world can move around our practices, that the practices become the flow of life, just like sleeping and eating and brushing our teeth are sort of become in a way unarguable. And I'm very grateful for that. And it gives me enormous hope, because actually particularly related to this book that this source has come from, is really about how we shift our practices so as to respond to the world that's calling to us. And it gives me enormous hope that we can do that. We can shift our practices. It's hard, and it takes an enormous amount of dedication and sort of the unfamiliarity and the talking to everybody about it. But to declare and then practice is really a thing. So
I just remember something really fun.
Yeah.
Which is that I remember when we were having dinner once, and your gorgeous middle son decided to try and make up a jingle for Turning Towards Life, which to me is an expression of the commitment as well of everyone around you. Because I think he came up with something actually quite excellent. I'm not sure whether we're at jingle phase in our career as Turning Towards Lifers, but I just want to appreciate that happened once, and that we have musicians in your realms, certainly, that might be able to help us when we require broadcast quality music to be accompanying our forays into this.
It's lovely, isn't it?
So sweet.
Yes, I've enjoyed actually that we maybe one day we'll have music and things, but I've enjoyed that we turn up and we talk, and there's no fanfare, and there's no I've been listening to some podcasts I love where, for one reason or another, the model is that the person who's hosting the podcast also has to read out like an advertisement from somebody who's sponsoring the podcast.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that we found a way to not do that.
No, I always want to fast forward
life insurance
kind of
or you know, something. And obviously people do it for good reason. But I'm very glad that we can just begin and we can talk, and here we are. It's lovely. So our source is, as everyone, if you're maybe you're with us for the first time, perhaps, that we always begin with a source, like a sort of a wellspring for our conversation. And you can always find it in our Facebook group, which is a wonderful place where sometimes there's great conversation goes on about things, and in the show notes to the podcast, and on our very lovely Turning Towards .life website, where you can also sign up for weekly emails where you get the source and the recording of this conversation altogether. So you're welcome to check that out. And this source comes from a book by a person whose name is James Bridle. And they have written this book called Ways of Being. And here's which I am loving. I've fallen deeply in love with. And here's a part from the introduction called Nature is Imagination. The phrase, the more than human world, refers to a way of thinking which seeks to override our human tendency to separate ourselves from the natural world. The erroneous idea that there is a neat divide between humans and non-humans, between our lives and the teeming, multitudinous living and being of the planet. The more than human world acknowledges that the very real human world, the realm of our senses, breath, voice, cognition, and culture, is but one facet of something vastly greater. All human life and being is inextricably entangled with and suffused by everything else. This broad commonwealth includes every inhabitant of the biosphere, the animals, plants, fungi, bacteria, and viruses. It includes the rivers, seas, winds, stones, and clouds that support, shake, and shadow us. These animate forces, these companions on the great adventure of time and becoming, have much to teach us and have already taught us a great deal. We are who we are because of them, and we cannot live without them. These things are beings, not passive props in the drama of our own preoccupations, but active participants in our collective becoming. Everything is really everyone. And so all those beings have their own agency, points of view, and forms of life. And being itself is relational, a matter of interrelationship. All that is required for sticks and stones to leap into life is our own presence. There is only nature in all its eternal flowering, creating microprocessors and data centers and satellites, just as it produced oceans, trees, magpies, oil, and us. Nature is imagination itself. Let us begin to imagine anew with nature as our co-conspirator, our partner, our comrade, and our guide.
Nature is imagination. The phrase, the more than human world, refers to a way of thinking which seeks to override our human tendency to separate ourselves from the natural world. The erroneous idea that there is a neat divide between humans and non-humans, between our lives and the teeming, multitudinous living and being of the planet. The more than human world acknowledges that the very real human world, the realm of our senses, breath, voice, cognition, and culture, is but one facet of something vastly greater. All human life and being is inextricably entangled with and suffused by everything else. This broad commonwealth includes every inhabitant of the biosphere, the animals, plants, fungi, bacteria, and viruses. It includes the rivers, seas, winds, stones, and clouds that support, shake, and shadow us. These animate forces, these companions on the great adventure of time and becoming, have much to teach us and have already taught us a great deal. We are who we are because of them, and cannot live without them. These things are beings, not passive props in the drama of our own preoccupations, but active participants in our collective becoming. Everything is really everyone, and all those beings have their own agency, points of view, and forms of life. And being itself is relational, a matter of interrelationship, All that is required for sticks and stones to leap into life is our own present. There is only nature in all its eternal flowering, creating microprocessors and data centers and satellites, just as it produces oceans, trees, magpies, oil, and us. Nature is imagination itself. Let us begin to imagine anew with nature as our co-conspirator, our partner, our comrade, and our guide.
Thank you, Lizzie. I've been walking a lot on Hampstead Heath, as you know, near where I live. In fact, I go there every day. And I've been walking very often with people who I'm coaching as part of my third space life. And one of the things that I've discovered recently that is right in the heart of this way that James says, these animate forces, these companions on the great adventure of time and becoming, have much to teach us and have already taught us a great deal. We are who we are because of them and cannot live without them. I've been wondering for a while what it is to let what is around us that isn't us literally actually be our teacher. So we've been hanging out on the heath and doing things like, instead of trying to solve things by talking them through and thinking them through, which of course has its own merits because that's part of what being a human is, we've been doing things like leaning into trees, leaning our backs into trees, and then seeing what kind of truthfulness comes that a tree can teach us. Because, for example, trees struck me for a while, pretty much as James is saying here, are pure being, and they're deeply, deeply relational. It's unarguable when you look at trees and see how they are deeply intertwined in everything around. But I also think they're in relationship with us, and we find this out by leaning your back into a tree and just simply asking what would the tree say now if it wanted to say something about me and this tangle that I'm in the middle of. And it turns out that if we let trees do that for us, we get in contact with something in us that is different to the something that we're ordinarily in contact with. So it doesn't even have to be imagining that the tree is speaking. All it has to be is letting ourselves be in contact with that in us, of us, that is already tree-like, because we're totally not separate from the world that made trees, as James is saying. And what the miraculous, maybe not miraculous, but maybe wonder-inspiring thing about it is that in my experience so far, there is always something else to see and say that comes from that, and it's always life-giving. Cuts through a very particular sort of human, you know, the sort of tangled preoccupations we're in, and gets to something true. And if trees can teach us that way, then so can stones, and so can fungi, and so can lakes, and so can the clouds. And I'm finding this both very moving but also very hope-filling, because the thing that I think that James is pointing us into, that I mean, I really know from myself, is how separate it's possible to feel, and the perils of feeling separate in that way. The perils and the limits to the way I'll think or respond to things, or how alone I get to feel. And so this invitation to see ourselves as part of a teeming world filled with everyone's, not things. It seems at this moment to me so straightforwardly, obviously, a brilliant way for us to learn to reorient ourselves.
And so, what's the word? Like the word comforting and soothing is coming up, you know, just to listen to the possibility of all of this. And as you were talking, I can't remember the name of this book, but there's a children's book about when you see a rainbow, or when you see the sunshine, or when you see the moon, that they are you. So to be in relationship with them as if they're you, like I am rainbow, I am moon, I am sunshine. And ever since reading that book, it's been, you know, I've mentioned this so many times, Justin, about my path of kind of receiving my life. For me, that's such a big part of it too, is like to be with the rainbow and not consume it or try and consume it, which isn't possible, but to see it, to feel it, to be with it as if it's an aspect of my being, which helps me be connected with it, that so that there isn't this, where does James say it? There's not a neat divide between me and a rainbow. But to cultivate the non-neat divide in my own understanding and in my own experience, so that the rainbow can be part of me rather than something out there that I search for or see once and then hold it close as a memory, which is, of course, is also beautiful, but to be in relationship with the rainbow, that it could also be me. And as you say, that I could access and receive wisdom as the rainbow. Like, what does the rainbow piece of me feel here? What does the rainbow piece of me have to give in this conversation with myself? And it's reminding me, Justin, of, you know, any parent, caregiver will know, like in the middle of the night when it's dark and you're fuffling around with the child and things are all going wrong, or maybe you wake up in the night and there's nothing to do with children but you're alone and it's dark and it feels quiet and like no one else must be awake in the whole universe, it's just you. Like in those moments, for there to be this relationship to the rainbow or the moon or the sunshine or the darkness or the stars, how helpful that is to feel and have a means of like of reconnecting to life, rather than feeling the kind of desolate tragedy of scrambling about in the middle of the night on your own. Like I often feel like something about nighttime that enhances the separation for me. And I'm really enjoying this sense that this whole teeming, James used the word teeming, this whole teeming world of nature and life is offering itself to us, whether we remember it or notice it or not. You know, the tree remains the tree, whether I go and put my back against it or not. It's like this benevolent offering that's available to us if we relate. It's like however we choose to relate to it will be how it gives itself to us. And for me, that's the really magical thing, is that we have the capacity as human beings to determine, choose, cultivate our relationship with whatever we want to. So we can go and let the tree be our friend, or we can let the tree be an object that we look upon and think, oh, that's amazing, and turn and walk away. Or we can be in conversation with it. We can receive from it. We can learn from it. We can ask it questions. We can ask it to speak if we want. Like, we can do all of these things, and that goes for everything in nature. You know, I remember doing a bonkers meditation course where I had to spend 8 hours with a stone once and then come back and say what happened. And, you know, there were like 1,000 people doing it, so I couldn't get out of it because it was like, what was happening? And all kinds of things arose, like, this is ridiculous. Who does this? Why would I stare at a stone? This is just a stone. And by the end of the time, I was completely in love with this stone. The stone became precious to me because of the time I had spent with it. And so I'm really appreciating that that's what kind of beings we are. You know, it was such a learning for me that that's what's possible, that I can have all of this understanding about the nature of a stone and my relationship with it, and that that can change based on my presence. Like James says, all that is required for a stone to leap into life is our own presence. It's like, I didn't really connect that story to this when I was reading it or when you were reading it, but I know that to be true from that experience, that it's my presence was the thing that had it be alive.
Hmm. All that's required for sticks and stones and rainbows and trees to leap into life is our own presence. I was really moved by what you said about rainbows, actually, Lizzie, because it was only a few days ago that also right near Hampstead Heath, I was walking along the road at the bottom of the heath, and there was this amazing rainbow over the city behind me, and I stopped for a while, and I looked at it, and I also found myself doing that thing that I think many of us have found ourselves sort of being schooled in doing by the culture that we live in, is I took photos of it. And I love the photos. It's not that there's anything wrong with the photos. They're a lovely memory. But what I feel very deeply invited into by your talking about it would be to the difference between looking at a rainbow over there and going how beautiful it is. And obviously the first step is to notice that there's a rainbow at all, because it's easy in this way that James is, I think James is pointing out something that's of absolutely monumental importance. The erroneous idea that there's a neat divide between humans and non-humans has been the guiding principle of the culture that so many billions of people have grown up in and been schooled in. And it has us take this detached perspective. And I was thinking about learning biology at school, and how, when I think about it now, it was very fascinating, and I love biology, and how on the outside of it, I felt, you know, we would be looking at a frog from the outside, or studying cells from the outside in a detached, from a detached perspective, which opens up a lot, and it's important that we can stand aside. But as the only mode of being that's available to us, it's very, very limited, and you could say that it's deeply at the root of our feelings of separateness and loneliness and alienation, and also the way that we despoil and manipulate and try to gouge out this planet that we live on. And that maybe what's happening, and this wasn't from James Bridle, it was someone else I was reading this week, who was writing about a sort of hopefulness that there's the beginnings of a shift in wider culture towards a, more of an understanding of the aliveness of everything. And that's going to absolutely what it's going to be called for us to live well together and to live well on this planet. So I'm just imagining and remembering this rainbow, and how now, as because of what you said, I'm feeling into the rainbowness in me, and also the other way round, which is the aliveness in the rainbow, which isn't a living thing in the ordinary sense, of course, at all. I know that it's produced by refraction of light and raindrops and all of that, but if I can allow myself to have it come alive and also to present its otherness to me, I am both, there's both rainbowness in me, and the rainbow is an expression of a world that gave birth to me, that is also much bigger than me, and that feels really important as well. The rainbow and I are also kin in the same way that, as James says, data centers and satellites and magpies and fungi and trees and oceans are kin, that we were all born of the very same vast, deeply interconnected, interrelated living something. And I'm feeling into that, you know, what you were saying about the loneliness of the night, of not only the possibility that we might be more compassionate towards one another in the world when we start to do this, to have inside us the trees and the rainbows and the stones, but also that it is part of learning that we belong. When you belong to something, you also want to, inevitably what you want to do is you want to take care of that which you belong to. You don't want to. And also, when you belong to something, you can also feel supported in a way to belong to the world, even in the night when we feel furthest away. Maybe even the night is just another thing to be related to in the way that you're describing, that we can find the night that's in us, and then we don't feel so separate from the night. Would give us access to such imagination and possibility in ourselves that we might otherwise feel far away from, because we feel alone and we feel afraid.
Really, somehow when you said how a rainbow is made, I was suddenly aware of the fact that we can use scientific explanations to kind of deny everything about ourselves. Like, it's really helpful to know that how a rainbow is made in some way, but there's so much more to a rainbow than the science of it. And so I'm just curious about, you know, I was in the park yesterday, Justin, and we saw starlings, and I'd been watching David Attenborough's, I can't remember what it's called now, Precious Isles or something, this new documentary about the British Isles. And there was a whole section on starlings. And I was like, oh my gosh, I've never seen starlings. That, you know, that's amazing. And they do this whole like night shoot of starlings to show what they do in the nighttime. It's like really brilliant. It's a BBC documentary. And anyway, we're in the park and there's this really big loud noise of bird chatter. And then I just happened to look to my left and they're all sitting in this huge tree, obviously having a conversation, which I've just seen a documentary about, and I could, you know, see what was going on in like my own experience. And all of a sudden they flew. So they did the thing where they kind of breathe and murmurate and move together and respond and carry on chattering at the same time. And I stood and got to see starlings for the first time in my life doing the thing that starlings do in this big pack. It was amazing. And the people I was with started saying, well, why do they do that? And how are they staying at the same speed as one another? And so someone started asking, well, why do they stick to one another? Why do they go in the same direction? Why do they do what they do? Why do they respond like they respond? And in that moment, I was kind of caught in the magic of, like, you know, they looked like a pair of lungs or something, or they were breathing. They were kind of sometimes you see with dough where the way that somebody kneads the dough and pulls it apart, like they were just being starlings. And I could feel in that moment how to kind of scientificize them both might bring magic, because it's like complete awe in why they're doing what they're doing, of course. But then also it was possible for me to feel the deadening that can happen by explaining everything away, like giving everything an explanation, and how it feels so vital to stay connected to both the explanation and the mystery and the wonder, because they're both right there side by side. And of course, I'm sure within science that belongs too, but so much of the way I've encountered that, like you were saying in your biology lesson, is there's a kind of an othering or a looking at it from the outside and not feeling our part in the murmuration of the starling, not feeling my humanness as the murmuration, but making it something different to me by explaining it away. And that's the kind of cultural givenness that we've been invited into of how to relate to a murmuration of starlings. There's something over there and I can explain why it happens. And in that explanation, I could feel my separateness from the magic and the experiencing of me as that, you know, to be able to stand there in the nothingness and the wonder for as long as it takes for me to feel like I am that and that is me feels really vital. And it's so easy for that to be cut down so short that I couldn't even do that, because we'd all just gone into explanation mode kind of thing. And yet I know that in this moment, just I'm sitting here, I can feel those starlings in my heart, like the vision of them, like it's so precious what I saw. The shape is like, it's not separate to me in this moment. That visual sense of the breathingness, like that must. I mean, I'd like to have a conversation about how a memoration of starlings is me and I am them. Like I can feel already, if you and I were in the park and you were coaching me, and we stood there with the starlings, and what kind of conversation we could have about what about me that was, and what about them I was, like we could imagine what we'd receive.
I'm going to try and find there's always an image that goes with these conversations, and I'm going to try and find the one I was looking for, which I didn't find, which was a murmuration of starlings over Brighton Pier, where they fly in the most amazing ways. And I'm also, Lizzie, so moved and excited to feel into that, how the starlings are us and how we are the starlings, and also how the starlings show us something that we might yet be. Because the starlings also have something to teach us. And your language is so beautiful, that they breathe. That's exactly right. They breathe, that movement that you made, your hands. And so what I'm thinking is, exactly as you're saying, we could reduce the movement of the starlings to the rules about how starlings keep distance from one another that produces those extraordinary patterns. That would be one way we could do it. And it's certainly has some value. And I'm thinking, as you were saying, it's about one of the things that James writes about a lot in the book is the work of Suzanne. I think her name is Suzanne Simard, who is one of the key people who has discovered, the trees knew this already, but from the human point of view, how social trees are and how they communicate by the mycelium under the ground of fungi. And that took science, but it also took very, very clearly a willingness to step out of the certainty that we humans are, that our explanations are the explanations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when someone says, why do the starlings do that? I don't think science can answer the question why the starlings do it. It might be able to tell us something about how they do it.
Mm.
But why they do it is what the starlings have to teach us, not something that we can find out by our analysis. Because that's a question of meaning and belonging and purpose and living and unfolding. And that's what Suzanne Simard did. And also Robin Wall Kimmerer, who studies grasses and who's got this amazing book, Braiding Sweetgrass, who is also a scientist, talks about inhabiting the corn from the inside. Studying corn. And the first thing she does is when she studying something is try to let herself inhabit its world, be taught by its world before she does any of the acts of separating and stepping aside, and sort of moving between our capacity to step aside and look and say, well, rainbows occur, the physics of rainbows is this, but then allow ourselves to inhabit the meaning of rainbows and the experience of rainbows and the rainbowness of rainbows, and treat it, as James says, the possibility that we might treat everything as a being, everything as an everyone. And then let nature, because we are not separate from it, be our imaginative guide. I want to know how to live with the feeling of breathing that the murmuration of starlings have. I want to know that of myself, and I wonder what possibilities for relating and taking care and experiencing and wondering and being in awe and joy comes from that.
I feel like I was just breathing, Justin, and feeling the shape of the starlings, like in my body. Because I breathe in, I can feel them kind of... And I love it that James says nature is imagination, because I can feel that what it does, this conversation for me, Justin, is it throws in this whole new possibility. Like you said, when you're working with your client on Hampstead Heath, a whole new possibility gets thrown in about like how to think, how to relate, how to approach something that's of a different order than our usual ways of trying to figure something out or sort it out or grapple with it or something. And I can feel the kind of spaciousness arising in me of, you know, bringing a question of, well, what shall I do next with my life or something? And instead of writing a chart or, I don't know, trying to find a book about it or something, I could bring the question to places that are unusual. And see what different kind of conversation opens up in my life. So I'm feeling very allowing and inviting of my imagination as nature to be helpful and supportive and opening and leading for all of us.
Wonderful, wonderful place to end, Lizzie, that we might address our questions of our lives by going and being taught by a river. By starlings or by the moon, instead of our own analytical propensities, which will tell us something, but for sure not the whole thing. Oh, well, thank you for, as always, for being so open and generous and joyful and willing to be in whatever conversation arises. I feel like we're trying to practice here exactly what James is inviting as well, which is to allow life to whoosh in and through us and to discover together rather than, you know, think about how different these conversations would be if we planned them. They'd be a whole different thing. I also want to say thank you to all of you who are here with us. I want to say a particular thank you to the person, you may be listening, you'll know who you are, who first walked with me on the heath and was open and willing to discover together the truth that trees could tell us, which was a generous kind of openness on your behalf that you did that, and so much came from that. So if you're with us this morning, thank you to you very specially. And Lizzie, you and I will be back, all being well, this time next week for a source that you're going to bring us.
Thank you, Justin. Thank you, everyone.
Bye.